Nancy attempted, and I'm an alcoholic.
Whoa.
You know, I'm real excited to do this. You know, I'm scared, but I'm excited, and it was fun. And I told everybody that I know that I'm speaking, because this is the big league up here, you know. And when I first was asked to speak, I thought, oh, a new meeting, I'll be the fourth speaker. It's probably going to be 40 people. Sure, I'll do it. And I came here the first meeting, and there was something like 230 people, and my stomach dropped. I got scared. And, you know, tonight I'm pretty calm. I'm pretty calm. I already got scared 4 weeks ago, you know. But what I want to try to do today is tell you a little bit about my story. I want to qualify myself, you know, that I did earn my seat here. But I've been sober for 22 years this month, you know, and so I've had a lot of miracles. I've had a lot of miracles in the 22 years that I've been here, and I don't want to slight that. They're not as dramatic and hair-raising as some of it is before I got here and what happened. But I've just had a lot of blessings, and there's a lot of people here. And I came to this meeting, and it was really kind of nice because I saw people that knew me in the beginning, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth year. So when I tell my story, they're going to say, I remember when she was like that. I remember when she dressed like that, you know, because I came in and I was tough. I was tough. You know, when I got here, I wore tight jeans, didn't wear a bra, tall heels, and smoked 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. And I kept everybody away, you know. And my first sponsor was a guy, because I did not trust you women, because if you were like me, you were not to be trusted, you know. If you were nice to me, there was something I had you wanted. And I didn't have anything when I got here. But whatever it was, if there was anything, you wanted it. So, you know, I kind of kept the women at bay. I am an alcoholic, and I said that. And I drank my whole story, and I hit my bottom on alcohol. But I did have some other issues, outside issues, you know, that helped me to get here quicker. And so I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but I can't tell my story without telling that part, so I hope I don't offend anybody. I was a native San Diegan, you know, and I was born here all my life, and I was born to a mother that was 14 years old when she had me, and she was deaf. So all of a sudden, you know, from an early age, I was different, and I wasn't like the kids that I played with that had families. You know, it was my mother and my grandmother and my Uncle Jim, who was like my mother's little brother, you know. And I used to make up stories that my dad was killed in the war and things like that, you know. And my grandmother was my mother figure, and she died when I was 7, so it was like I lost my mother. And I had to be an adult. I was an adult child, you know, trying to be very responsible. And because my mother was deaf, you know, I had to be her ears and her voice. So I had to learn and do things that little kids shouldn't do. She married my stepdad when I was just before my grandmother died. And so I had a stepdad, and he was also deaf, and we spoke sign language. And so I would have to go with him on job sites and ask for work when he'd get laid off. He was a lath and plasterer, and, you know, and go and say, my dad needs work. Is there any work for him? You know, and my mother needed to go to the doctor. You know, I had to go there and ask questions and interpret about things that a 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old should not have to even know about. With it. So I was like a real responsible child. But I also was a brat, a terrible brat, because I would threaten to not talk for my mother if I didn't get my way. You know, I would threaten, I'm not going to talk, or I'm going to say something different. You know? So I was a handful. I was a handful. But, you know, right from the very beginning, I knew I felt different. You know, I knew I felt different, and I was very responsible. And I didn't take a drink, and I didn't party, and I didn't do any of those things until I got married at 16 years old. I had a child. I didn't have to get married, but I just thought if I could get away from this home and have my own family, you know, I could get away and have my own family. So I got married at 16, and I was married about 6 months when I got pregnant. So I had my child at 17. My husband was a little bit younger. It's like I thought I was an adult, you know, and I wanted to do it my way. And, you know, but I didn't drink, I didn't use. And the few times that I did drink, I did get drunk and got sick and said, I'm not going to do that again. And I was afraid of drugs. And I'm a child of the 60s, and I was afraid of drugs. I mean, I did not know what they would do to me. But everything I put ingested in, and I didn't die, I wanted more of. And that's where the story started, and that's how it led. And so I got a divorce, you know, and I started partying and going to the bar, and I started feeling good, and I started feeling a part of, and I started feeling like I fit. You know, and all of you, we all have these stories. We've all said the same thing, so I won't dwell on that too much. But alcohol, at a later age, did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was able to feel comfortable around people. And so anyway, this husband was getting in my way. He was like, you know, telling me not to drink so much. And I had never smoked pot, but he did. And he introduced me to pot, and it didn't kill me, and I liked it. So then he didn't like it, you know. And then he was trying to tell me not to smoke so much pot, not to drink so much. Well, it was your idea in the first place, you know. It's your fault, you know. So then I started hanging around with this girl, and she asked me if I'd ever tried cocaine. And I said, no, I hadn't. And so I made the plan. I was going to take a line. I was going to do a line. And everything I ever touched, I did to excess. You know, so I started partying. I got rid of the husband. And my son decided to go live with his dad. And I was brokenhearted. Of course, that was good for a lot of drunks. My baby abandoned me. You know, I was the one that walked the floor and stayed up all night. You know, I was the one, and he abandoned me. And, you know, thank God he abandoned me. You know, thank God he had a brain in his head and didn't stay, because I did not have a clue what was normal. And when I continue with my story, my thinking was so delusional through my whole life. And because I, you know, was so responsible as a young child, I thought I had it together. You know, when I came into these rooms and saw those steps on the wall, and I saw that second step there, I thought that didn't apply to me. I was perfectly sane. I just drank too much. So anyway, I'm starting to party, and I'm starting to do this lifestyle, and I'm starting to like the way these drugs feel, you know. And they're very expensive. You know, and I had ended up, I was partying, and I ended up going to, finding this guy that they called him the Connect. And he had this, you know, super stuff, you know, that everybody wanted to get their hands on. So I would give somebody a little line of this, and they'd say, can you get some for me? And I'd say, well, sure. So I was running back and forth 5 and 6 times a night, picking up little half grams and quarter grams of cocaine for my friends, you know. And then for doing that, they'd give me a line, and, you know, and I said, back then it was 120 grams. It was good stuff. And that was a lot, you know, back then that was more like 300 or something, you know, the equivalent of currency. And so what happened is, he said, Nancy, he says, you've been coming back, and you've been here 5 times tonight. Why don't you just take this eight ball, and you can sit right here and use my scale and break it up, and you can, then you don't have to come so often. I said, are you sure? He said, yeah. So I sat there, and I broke it up, and I took this eight ball. I broke it up in different sizes, and I took it, and like 2 hours later, it was gone. And I went, wow, it's gone. So I went back over there and said, hey, he said, you sold it? I said, I sold it. Everybody wanted it. It was this, you know, high quality stuff. And so I thought, after that, I thought, I got a whole gram free. Well, I liked the way that worked. And that's where it started. That's where it started. You know, I did not set out to be a drug dealer. I did not set out to use cocaine on a daily basis. But that's where I ended up. You know, and so I did this for a while, tried to keep a job, tried to party, and I was balancing all these things, but I kept having more and more people call me. I ended up, one day somebody says, Nancy, I tried to call you. I needed to buy a couple of ounces. And I went, it was at work. I lost $500 going to work. You know? So it was costing me money to go to work. So I went, I thought I considered myself pretty bright. It was stupid losing money going to work. So I left the job behind. And so that's how that started, and it just grew from there, and I got one, I considered myself to be a person of integrity, and I considered myself to be an integrity drug dealer. And I was going to run it like a business, and I wasn't going to cut it, and I wasn't going to shortchange it, and I was only going to sell quality stuff, and I was always going to have it. And therefore, the quality people would come to me, and they would call me first. And I handled that pretty well, and I ended up making a really good living. I did. I ended up on it, and I thought about it, and I would get a house in the neighborhood, and I would get a house, and I would maybe that needed yard work, and I would rent this house. And then I would hire. And you can hire people. If I offered you $120 to redo my yard, you would laugh at me. But I could offer somebody a gram of high-quality cocaine, and they'd say, where do I start? And so I was a barterer. I bartered everything, and so I would make my yard be the showplace of the neighborhood. It was manicured, it was clean, it looked well, and the neighbors would turn their backs on a lot of things when you're making the neighborhood look good. And so I would do that. And then I rented a little apartment over in El Cajon, which I had an assistant sitting over there so I could divert traffic from my home. So I was running this like a little incorporated enterprise, And it was working quite well for me. And I really wasn't afraid because I stayed drunk all the time and high so that the fear of getting caught, it wasn't imminent, because if I got a little bit nervous, I just did another shot. And I did this for 7 years. I would always get somebody, a houseboy or something that was kind of good looking, that would hang around and help me weigh my stuff and kind of drive me places. And I always had one of those around. And and then I would have usually a girlfriend or somebody that would make sure that I ate and that my house was clean, because I've always been neat, but I just didn't want to do it and I was too busy. So we would party all night, and by the time I got up in the morning, I always had somebody that would come in and clean up the whole house, pick up the beer cans, wash the glasses, take out the trash, and then bring in a vodka tonic, a shot of vodka, and a line of cocaine, and then it was like, good morning. And that was how I got up, and that is how I lived for 7 years. And I did my job through the day. I got my stuff weighed out. Actually, the houseboy weighed the stuff out, and I watched him, to make sure he did it right and didn't steal too much. Because, people do steal. But anyway, like I said, I was running it like a business and thought I was going to be very, do it with integrity. And, and they're going to buy it from somebody. It might as well be from someone with integrity. So that went on for a while. And January 13th, Friday the 13th to be exact, 1984, the DEA and the FBI changed my life as I knew it. What had happened was, it was like, don't ask, don't tell. The stuff I was getting was so high quality. I knew it had to be coming from way up the line. I knew it had to be organized crime, and I knew everybody that I got from had names like Jose and Pancho and things like that, and I was the only gringo in the bunch, and I just didn't ask. But when you got things like solid rock, I knew it was coming directly from the source, and that's why I was able to be so successful at it, because I got this connection, and So it wasn't anything I did to get caught. I was really careful. You know, I had the best yard in the neighborhood. I even had a little annex off in El Cajon. But what had happened was my dealer, whom I gave his own name so nobody would know who he was. I called him Pancho, and actually the reason I called him Pancho was because I had stolen him from my other dealer, and I didn't want anybody to know who I was dealing with. So that's why I had given him, because, you know, that was the competition. And so what happened is he called me. It was New Year's Eve, and from somebody in San Ysidro who was a big mucky muck. I didn't know those people. I kind of knew they were there, but I didn't know them. And, you know, he called me from their house, and the FBI had a wiretap. And he called to see if I needed anything. And I said, no, I'm okay, but call me back in a few hours. I'll let you know, because it was, you know, New Year's Eve. You know, it might need some more. And the FBI was monitoring that, and they went, wow, who's this Pancho guy? We know there's a new player in the game. It was, you know, so they thought that they didn't know who I was. But there was a raid. It was, like I said, January 13th, 1984, simultaneous, all around town, all the way up to San Francisco. There was this giant raid, and we were all rounded up at the same time, so nobody could warn anybody, and I was taken to some place in National City, and we were all put on a bus. We were all put on a bus and carted down to the federal prison at MCC. Now, when the FBI was there searching through the house, I said, can I have a drink? They said, no. Well, this was the goodest time of any, as I thought, to have a drink. So I had a bottle of vodka there, and I was handcuffed, but I was able to fill that water glass full of vodka. And I'm handcuffed, and they think I'm drinking water, and I'm drinking. And pretty soon, on the way in the car, the FBI says, she's drunk! They go, you said you wouldn't drink. And I said, I lied. Arrest me. So, here I went. Now, the part that I want to talk about, too, is the insanity of this disease. I got a suspended sentence, but I'm going a little bit too quick. Is that I didn't do drugs. That was in January, and in July I went to prison. But I didn't know what was going to happen to me from January to court in June. And I was scared to death, and I thought it's too late to try to find work, because if I find work, just get started, they'll throw me in jail. You know, I just didn't know what to do, so I went to my mom's, but to her dismay, I just drank. You know, a lot of people owed me a lot of money, and nobody wanted to talk to me anymore. And before that, it was like they used to give me pictures that say the Snow Queen. I go, yes, that's me. You know, this, you know, was terrible. You know, I was very popular. And after that bus, nobody wanted to talk to me. I didn't have anything. I didn't have any money, and I was calling people up, begging for 5 cents on the dollar of money they owed me, you know. And so the insanity of the disease, I just stayed drunk all those few months, you know. And then I went to court, and because I had a good record, and I had never been in any trouble before, they let me off a suspended sentence, 5 years sentence, suspended, 120 days in a halfway house. And, you know, I just was not ready to do what anybody told me to do. I was fighting the system. I was still trying to do it my way. I was still trying to figure it out. I was still trying to, how am I going to beat the system, you know? And so I was always being a con artist, always a con artist. And so I was paying girls. I'd go in, I'd sign into the halfway house, and then I would leave, and then I would pay them $5 to sign me out. Back in, you know, and I'd leave and I'd go party. Now, I couldn't do drugs because I was being I was being tested, but I sure drank. And you know, all those yets started happening because I didn't have the drugs to keep me going. You know, it was like a line of perk up, a little bit too drunk, another line, you know, another shot. And that's how I lived for a long time. And one night there was an accident out in front of the halfway house, and one of the persons saw me driving off in a car, so I violated, and I went before the judge. I got called before the judge. She says, "I've had it with you. We let you walk right there. She threw me in prison. You know, she says, you're doing your 5 years. Take her away." I'm like there with my mouth open, but you don't know who I am. You know, I just still thought. I was so delusional. I still thought I could get away with it, you know. And thank God I surrendered. Thank God I surrendered. And the insanity of it is, I kept talking to the women in there and saying, "How do I get out of there?" And they'd say, "Pray." I'd go, "Pray? Don't tell me. Pray. I need some action. I need to be able to do something." I'd always been able to figure it out, you know. And I talked to my lawyer and I said, "Get me out of here." He said, "You have been sentenced. You were suspended. You violated. You are in here." And I'm so grateful that I was stupid, how the system worked. I didn't know that once you were sentenced, you couldn't get out. Otherwise, I would not have tried. You know, if I'd have known that, I would not have tried. But I wrote the judge a letter, and I told her that I had some time sober now, that the reason that I had done everything that I did, the reason that I had violated was because I was a drunk, I was an alcoholic, and now that I have not had a drink in some time, I know I could be a productive member, and live and be productive to society. And I wrote her this letter. I had told my attorney, and I thought, you know, you already got your money. That's why you won't do anything to help me. You've been paid, and you're out of here. Well, I wrote the judge this letter. My attorney came to see me, and he said, "You will not believe it. The judge said she'll see you." And I went, "I did." You know? So I went before the judge and I gave her my spiel, and she said to me that they weren't going to do anything else for me. They weren't going to do anything else for me, but if I, on my own, could find a program, she says, "I will consider it. I'm not saying I'll do it, but you have to do it on your own. You're not going to do it from any help from us." So I started writing letters to halfway homes and programs. And then I was in the federal prison, so you had to get court orders for anybody to come in. So I'd have to get a court order to get an interview. And here's the insanity of it. But, you know, God knew what he was doing even before I knew there was God. See, at this time I didn't believe there was God. And so a lady came, and it was a 9-month program, and it sounded religious and it sounded strict, and I went, "Oh, I can't do this for 9 months." And I told her, "You know, I'm really more of an alcoholic than a drug addict, and your program seems more like for addicts." And she said, "Fine," and she left. And my lawyer came in and he says, "Are you nuts?" He says, "Look around. You are in prison. You know," he says, "and you're being picky?" And I just said, but see, I knew in my heart I couldn't follow those rules, and I couldn't have at that time because I still had not surrendered. I still had not found a God. So there was this halfway house called the Crossroads, and it had a 90-day program, and I liked that. It was for alcoholic women, and you only had a week's restriction, and after so many weeks, you could have overnights, and you could go out to work, and, you know, I go, okay, I can do it for 90 days. So I got the court order came in, and I talked to this lady, and I said, "Please take me. You won't be sorry. You won't be sorry." And so she says, "Well, I'll put you on a list." And so we went before the judge, and she told the judge what sort of a program she had. And the judge says, "Well, you're going to stay here, but I'm going to let you out." Now, this is God had a plan for me, because you don't get out of jail. That's like somebody doing life. And the judge says, "I changed my mind because you wrote me a nice letter." You know? And that's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened, and that is the miracle. And I wanted to make sure that I said that, because it's a miracle. You know, that's almost like the dead walking, you know, because after I learned how impossible it was to get out and to have that happen. And then I want to talk about the insanity of this disease, because I was promised by this same judge that if I did anything to violate that house, that I would do my 5 years. She said, I promise you, you will not do a day less. No good time, no work time. That is my promise to you. I go, oh, you don't have to worry. I will be a model resident. Well, I wasn't a model resident. Now, the insanity of alcoholism, cunning and baffling and powerful. 3 times at that house I snuck and drank. I snuck and drank. I came in the house after drinking, after being out. I came in and I was sitting up there with the girls, and one of the girls smelled it on me. And she didn't tell on me because she didn't want to be responsible for me doing 5 years in prison. I got my 90 days behind me. I got out, and I was allowed to drink. That was not on my probation. I just couldn't do drugs. So I drank, and I drank, and all those yets happened. And I blamed that dry spot on it. That dry spot when I was in jail ruined my drinking. You know, that was my thinking. I didn't black out unless I'd been on a big run before. And this time, every time I drank, I didn't have any fun anymore. I was just drunk. I went from not very comfortable to drunk, you know, and to waking up and just barely surviving. But I'll tell you what did happen when I was in that halfway house, even though I was just going through the motions. I didn't want to be in jail. It's that I got curious about that chapter to the agnostic. You know, that made me kind of like, you know, maybe there is something. I don't think all you guys got together to pull a big joke on Nancy. You know, there might be something to it. So I read it, and I kept reading that chapter over and over, and I'm so grateful that I did, because when the time came, I needed it. I needed it. And, you know, I just drank, and I got a job as a little girl Friday that didn't take much brains, and it just, you know, and I would try to, you know, get enough work in that I could just get home and then get another bottle and drink and pass out, and that was the way it was. And I, you know, I always considered myself a neat person, but, I mean, I was sleeping in my clothes because it was just too difficult to try to get dressed, you know, it was just too difficult to try to get dressed. And, you know, I had gone to meetings, you know, because I had a court slip and I had a judge on my butt, and they'd hand me, and people would come up to the newcomer and say, here's my number, and I'd say, thank you very much, thank you. Trash can, you know? And, you know, I had no intention of using those phone numbers. And then, you know, the last 10 days of my drinking, this was... You know, I'm really grateful for it, because it's helped me to be willing to do, to surrender. I had to surrender. I had to give up. And from the story I've just told you, you can see how stubborn I was. And so what happened is, the last 10 days of my drinking, you know, I couldn't drink that terror away. I was full of terror and hyperventilating, and I would take a drink, and it would be like I had burnt my hand and I got to stick it in ice water. And what would happen is, I took that drink, and I just kept feeling it. I could not shut it off. I could not get drunk. And I'd been like that for 10 days, and I remembered, you know, I would go in my room, and I was rocking on the bed back and forth, breathing into a bag, because I was hyperventilating and so full of fear, and that I couldn't drink it away. And I remember thinking, if I don't get some relief pretty soon, I'm going to have to think of ways to kill myself, you know, because that, to me, was the only way out. I felt like I was holding on to a thread of sanity, and it was going to snap, and there would be no coming back. You know, I was just tired. And I was rocking on that bed, and I remembered I said the only prayer that I've ever meant in my life, and I didn't even know there was a God there. And I said, God help me. God help me. And I was out of booze, and I had $5 that I thought I had $5 in my wallet. And I had not asked anybody for money because I was very prideful, but I knew that in a pinch, I would go to my family and demand $5 for a bottle. And they wouldn't want to give it to me, but I could guilt them into it because I'd never asked them for any money. And I knew I would come out of there with that. And I would humiliate myself and do it, but I was going to do it. So, but just for a last shot, I was digging through my wallet to see if there was some money tucked in there. And because I was in bad shape, and I looked through it, and there was those cards, and I don't know what that card was doing in my wallet. I thought I'd thrown them all away, but it said, if you want to drink, that's your business, but if you want to stop, we have a solution. And there was a phone number there, and I called that phone number, and I said, you don't know me, but I have this card. And a lady came and met me, and she came and met me, and that was June the 12th, 1985. She came and met me at a coffee shop and stayed with me till the liquor store closed. And for that, I will be forever grateful. And then I'd like to say it was easy, but I had the worst 3 days of hell. I did not know you could die from just cold turkey and drink, cutting drink it out. I'm glad I didn't know that even. You know, sometimes ignorance, behooves me. Because I did not know that either. So I went to my mom's house and I said, Mom, I'm going to try to stop drinking. Can I sit on your couch? And she said, yes. And I was shaking and I was hyperventilating. And I thought for sure if I took the alcohol away, I would just self-destruct, blow up. Because I felt like that with the alcohol. And so I'm shaking and I'm breathing into bags and I'm a mess. And I looked over and I saw that Bible on her nightstand. And I thought, you know, I couldn't have read it or anything, but I somehow knew that God helped me is what got me to this point, to that decision. And I reached over and I put that Bible on my chest and I held it. I held it and I shook and I fall asleep for a few minutes at a time. And if that Bible started to slide off my chest, I'd grab it because I knew if it got off me, I would just die. I knew that Bible was the only thing holding me together. So even to go to the bathroom, I'm trying to do it with one hand because that Bible could not come off my chest, you know. And that was the beginning. And then the morning of the third day without a drink, I got up and I was weak and I was tired and I was worn out, but I could breathe. The hyperventilating was gone. The heart palpitations were gone, and I knew the worst was over. And I walked in to the alcohol alarm club, and I said, what do I have to do to stay here? And people were willing. They loved me. They were willing to help me. And, you know, I didn't think you had a choice. I had nothing. I had used everything up. And there's some of you out there that know me from the beginning, and you know, if you know me, you know me because you saw me at 5-6 meetings a day. Because that was the only place I was safe. And I went to a meeting every day for at least 10 years. And the first 6-7 months, I went to 3 and 4 a day, you know, because that's all I could do was go to meetings. And I went to meetings, and I was a sponge, and I surrendered. And I can tell you when I said to those people at the Alcohol Anonymous Club, this is the big turning point for me, is I stopped fighting everything and everyone. And they said, start cleaning these ashtrays up. And I wanted to say, ashtrays? I mean, this made no sense to me, but I started to say, what the... Yes, and I started cleaning ashtrays, and I have done everything that's been asked of me ever since. And it's been, you know, you don't get from where I was to where I am today. I want to make sure I get, see, I said I've been drunk too long. That's what I did not want to do. But anyway, you know, it's like everything that I have in my life today that's blessed, because I showed up at a meeting. And that's what I was taught, and that's what I try to pass on, is go to meetings. And I loved the 10-minute speaker. And last week there was a 10-minute speaker. I think his name was Brian, and they said they quit going to meetings and they drank. And I went, you know what, if I heard nothing else, that's what I came to hear. That's what I came to hear tonight. I have never rested on my laurels. I have never stayed away. I am too afraid. I don't want to risk it. Somebody says, well, do you still need to? I don't know. I don't want to find out. You know, I do not want to find out. You know, if I don't go to enough, you know, if I don't need to do all those things. I sponsor a lot of women. I have 4 meetings since this one started. I've been coming to this one since the first day. But I have gone for years to at least 3 meetings a week. I don't go every day because I believe in balance and having a life, you know. But I'm, I'm so blessed, and I have so many women in my life that I just love and that are so dear to me. And you know, we teach what we need to learn. And you know, and I know I'm telling them the truth, so it makes me believe it for me. You know, I just know I'm telling them the truth. And, I wrote down now a couple of sober stories. I hope I have time. I think I have 10 minutes, so I want to make sure I get some, the sober stories in there. And I'll tell you what I did when I first got sober. You know, a lot of things don't change. I still was running around looking for him at meetings. You know, I had nothing to do with drinking, but I was still trying to fill that hole up. And, you know, I'd go to meetings, and I did not want to go to women's meetings, because if I was at a women's meeting, I might miss him, and he's at the mixed meeting, you know. So I tried doing this for a while. And it wasn't working. It was not working. I was too sick to be in a relationship. It brought up all my feelings, all my emotions, all my insecurities, all my inadequacies that I didn't know I had because I drank, you know, and all these feelings came up, and I was just a mess. I had such a horrible hole that I could not do it. And I finally got so tired of trying to have a relationship sober that I got on my knees at 2 years sober, and I said, God, if it is your will that I never have a relationship again, I'm okay with that. See, I had to surrender everything. I am okay with that. Just help me not to be afraid to be alone. You know? And he sent me two of the wackiest newcomer women you'd ever want to meet in your life, and I was too busy for anybody. So, you know, he takes care of me, and I didn't date for 2 years. And I used to get asked out on a regular basis, because after all, I told you, I wore the braless tight pants and spiked heels and a cigarette sticking out of my mouth. So I got asked out on a regular basis. And so after I had said that prayer and I had surrendered it to God, and I thought to myself, nobody had asked me out in a long time. And I thought, wait a minute, nobody's asked me out. What happened? Did I get struck ugly overnight? You know, what happened? You know, because I would have swore I wasn't doing anything to get asked out, you know. And I said, I would like for somebody to at least ask me out so I could say, oh, well, thank you very much, but I'm not dating. And that didn't happen. It did not happen. Nobody asked me out for 2 years. So ladies, watch what you pray for. I've been married 13 years and with the same guy now, and he's in the program for 18 years. You know, and it's a wonderful relationship. Not perfect, but it's a good relationship. And I didn't know it was a date, or I wouldn't have went, because I got very okay not going through those roller coaster rides of feelings that I went through trying to date and trying to have a relationship, because all my fears and inadequacies would come out. And so, I did not want to rock the boat. You know, I was doing just fine sponsoring these ladies. We were hanging out. We were going to dinner. We were going to movies, going to breakfast, going for walks, you know. And I got okay. I got okay with me. But I needed to work on me some more, you know. And there was a buddy of mine that I'd see at meetings, you know. And I had quit smoking. And so I was calling up people, just like they tell you to do when you quit drinking. Pick up the phone, not a drink. Well, I was going to pick up the phone, not a cigarette. And I was calling the same women over and over again. I thought, these women are going to get sick of me. So I started going, you know, they're going to get tired of hearing about me. So I went through the phone book and was going through A, B, C, and I called one of these guys, and I said, oh, this is just Nancy. I'm just calling people because I quit smoking and I'm crazy. You know, I quit smoking and I'm crazy. And he called me back. You know, and he said, let's go to dinner or a movie. And I was going to go anywhere with anybody at this time. I was nuts, you know. And we went out and we had a good time. And he opened the door for me, and he paid the bill and pulled my chair out. And I went, this is nice. I kind of like this. And I thought, I could do this with the girls, but they don't pay the bill and pull my chair out and open the door. You know. So he asked me out again. You know, and I had met this person when I was a year sober. We had gotten introduced, and, you know, and he wasn't my type, and I was telling that earlier, because somebody says, boy, your husband's so handsome, and I said, I didn't think so at the time. I liked the bad boys, because that's where I was, and he was not a bad boy, you know. He was a nice person, you know, and I was, but I was attracted to those ones with the tattoos and looked like they just got out of prison from pumping, you know, pumping iron. That's what, that was my kind of guy, you know. So I was, you know, really grateful that he wasn't my type, because you could see where that would have led me. And so anyway, we started going out, and he asked me out again, and I thought, well, you know, that's really amazing. You know, he asked me out again. He saw me at my worst, and, you know, he still likes me. And, you know, one day, you know, I did not, like I said, I did not know it was a date, or I probably wouldn't have went, because it was it's a lot of work, because being in a relationship makes you look at you again and again and again, and it's a lot of work, but I'm so grateful for it, you know. And one day we were just walking, and he reached over and he grabbed my hand, and I looked at him, and it was different. This is a person that's my best friend. This is my best friend, you know, and we've been together 18 years. We both had to do a lot of work, because you get two sick alcoholics with all their garbage and all their insane thinking, you know, and, you know, our feelings get hurt, and now, but it's so worth it. We are buddies. Nobody's going anywhere. We're in it for the long haul. It's like a comfortable pair of slippers, you know. He's my best friend. We call each other up. Oh, you know, we live together, but we still talk on the phone 2 or 3 times a day when he goes to work, you know. And that's awesome, and that's a true gift. That is a true gift, you know. And let me see what time it is. I think, okay, I got 5 minutes. So I've got a lot of gifts. I've got a lot of gifts in this program. And I can't say enough of the miracles that have happened in my life. And I remembered I got fired from a job. When I, you know, in the program, I did everything I was told. They said, suit up, show up, put one foot in front of the other. That'll be okay. And I, you know, I went to, I got this job, and I hated it. It was hard work. But I was there. I suited up, showed up, and I knew I gave it 110%, and I got fired, and I was heartbroken. I was just heartbroken because now I lost all of my sense of, I thought I was doing a good job. And now I said, now I can't even trust myself. I must have been doing a crappy job, or they wouldn't have fired me. You know, now I look back and see there could have been a lot of reasons that it happened. But, you know, I just took it and I internalized it. So then I was out on a journey to try to be self-supporting, because you guys told me I had to be self-supporting through my own contribution. So I was trying to find work, and I got a job at another place, and I worked there for like four weeks, and they went out of business, and I went, oh, at least I didn't get fired, you know, at least I didn't get fired. And but I just had no self-esteem, and I just said to God, I said, God, if it's your will, I said, you know, I'm so tired of being crazy, I'm so tired of being stressed, I said, I'm not going to look for a job till after Christmas, so if you want me to have a job, you're going to have to give it to me, because I'm not going to look. The next day, I walked up to the coffee machine at the Alcohol and Lotto Club again, and somebody says, Nancy, are your ears burning? And I says, what do you mean? And he said, well, I was just asking Chris what kind of clout he had in hiring people where he works. And he said, Nancy, are you looking for work? I said, no, I gave it to God. You know, and I had the day before. I says, but what do you got? And God gave me that job. He gave me that job, and I worked at that job for nearly 20 years. Nearly 20 years, you know. And there was just so many other miracles, you know. It's like when I was about 4 years sober, I went to my women's meeting, and I was sharing, and I shared with these women. I said, you know, my dream and my goal has always been to have my own place, but I've always said I couldn't have it. I'm just a waitress. I don't have credit. I don't have any money. I'm never going to have my own place. And I said, but I realize I've been limiting God. God never told me I couldn't have it. I told me I couldn't have it. And I said, and someday, somewhere, I know God's got a place for me. I'm going to have my own place. And I heard it at the same time the rest of the room heard it. Well, let me tell you, I walked up to that same coffee machine 2 days later. And somebody says, sell it to Nancy. She needs an investment. He says, are you looking for a place? I says, no. Why? You got a place? And he says, well, I took this condo in, and I don't want it. I had to take this condo. And he was a realtor. He was a newcomer. And still partially drunk. And I said, well, I don't have any credit, I don't have any this, I don't have it. He said, you don't have to qualify, it's a VA loan, it's a no, you know, you just assume it, you know. I just want my money back. I pay two payments, and every payment and every homeowner's fee that I have to pay is going to cost the next person more. He says, you want to go look at it? And I said, I don't care what it looks like. If I have it, I can fix it. You know, if I have it, I can fix it. So I drove, I was meeting like in 2 hours, and I drove there, and I was so excited. And I thought, you know what, if I have to lie and manipulate, I'm going to look at it as a door that's closed. You know, I'm going to try, I'm going to say it's not meant to be if I have to forge papers, because I was good at that. And I'm going to look at it as a closed door. And I went there. I looked at it. You know, it needed work. Yeah, it was ugly, but it could be fixed. It had four walls, a floor, and a ceiling, and it was mine. And I had the money to do it, and I bought it, and I still own that place today. I couldn't get back to that meeting fast enough. I had to wait till Friday to go back and say how fast God worked. And it was like he had it for me. He had it in his hand. He says, here, here. I had to, but all I had to do was believe that I could have it. You know, and as soon as I believed I could have it, I had it. You know, God has just blessed me. You know, I cannot believe the miracles in my life. It's not just, it's...